Now, in your Bibles, you may have this kind of a section here where it says paying taxes to Caesar. Okay, so by and large, the way that you know, you kind of read the headline here, and you probably think like, okay, we're about to get a bunch of instructions about how to use your money as Christians. That's not what's happening here. That's like a tiny sidebar to what Jesus is actually doing here. So we're gonna put this in context, right? Because this is not a financial education seminar. This isn't an idea about like how do we deal with taxes as Christians. That's not the point of the passage. What is the point? What is Jesus getting at? If you look back at the previous passage, and if you have been paying attention through our study through the Gospel of Luke, what has been happening is Jesus has been establishing his claim of who he is as the promised Son of God. He has been establishing this claim that he has authority, and he's making these pronouncements as to who he is based on his actions and his words. So we don't have time to go all the way back into super deep into Luke, but if you remember just a couple, just in the previous chapter, let's just even start there. He has this section that we refer to as the triumphal entry, or it's kind of what we celebrate on Palm Sunday. It's you know, the Sunday before Easter. And there, Jesus rides this colt down into Jerusalem, and the people have the palm fronds, and he rides on the cloaks of people, and they're shouting, Hosanna, and they sing that psalm that we talked about, Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, Psalm 118, 26. And it's there that he is coming on a particular day in a particular mode to communicate that he is this promised Savior, this promised Messiah. And then he rides down into this particular area onto the Temple Mount, and he sees that the area that is set aside for outsiders, the Gentiles. They're not the initial people, but God made a place for the surrounding nations to come and worship him. It's filled with merchants who are taking advantage of people. And Jesus comes in there and he says, I've had enough of this. He clears that out so that way the people can come in. And he says, you've made this a den of robbers, but this is supposed to be a place for the nations to come and worship. This is supposed to be a spot there for them to have this this place where they can meet with God. And then instead of, after he clears it out, instead of allowing that to resume there, he begins to teach there. He begins to communicate what's happening from his perspective of how God's kingdom is breaking into the world. And at the end of that, in chapter 19, verse 47, you read this description. He was teaching in the daily in the temple. The chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him. So they had enough of Jesus. They've been trying to get rid of him for a long time, but they were looking to get rid of him. Verse 48 tells us they did not find anything they could do, for all of the people were hanging on his words. And so they were excited about what Jesus was doing, what he was teaching. And then you find in the next passage, they come to Jesus and they directly challenge his authority, because the temple area, this is home court for the religious leaders. This is their space. This is what they're supposed to be overseeing. And Jesus comes in and he starts to rearrange things in the temple. And so they're upset about it. They don't like what's happening. And so in the next section, we see that as he's teaching there, in chapter 20, verse 1, the chief priests and scribes and elders, this is the collection of all the religious leaders we talked about last week as kind of being formally titled the Sanhedrin. They come up and they say, tell us by what authority you do these things, or who it is that gave you this authority. So they're challenging him and saying, like, where does your authority come from? Who gave you this authority? And then Jesus poses a question back to them to help shape his response and to shape their response, because they're trying to trick him. And so he says, well, I'm going to answer your question, but you've got to answer mine. Where does the authority of John come from? He descends back into a previous time in Israel's history there, and looking at that, because John promised that Jesus would be coming, and the people received John as a prophet, and so the religious leaders are kind of put on the spot there. They've got to make a decision. What do we think about John? Because if we deny John and the people think that John's a prophet, then they're going to kill us. But if we say that John is a true prophet and he's from God, then Jesus says, well, then why didn't you listen to John? Why are you not going to, why didn't you not listen to me then? And so they've been questioning his authority. And so this is kind of the background, right? And then he goes into this whole thing about the parable of the wicked tenants, which has to do with like who owns the vineyard. And it's another kind of authority passage. And then now we come into paying taxes to Caesar, which is not about financial literacy and education here, but rather about authority. This is what it's about. So he's framing this up for us with that background. Where does true authority come from? And so here's what happens after Jesus speaks this parable against the religious leaders that we looked at last week in the parable of the wicked tenants. This idea here that they are rejecting the owner of the vineyard. They're going their own way. They're not going to have their way. And verse 19 tells us that they perceive that he spoke this against them. They were there, they heard it, they understood, and again, they fear the people. And so they come up with a new plan. Verse 20, they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be sincere that they might catch him in something he said so as to deliver him up to the authority and jurisdiction of the governor. So here's the deal. They're like, okay, like we've tried all these traps. We've been trying to figure it out. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to come up with these guys who we're going to send in as spies, and they're going to go speak to Jesus, and they're going to ask him these questions. And the idea here is that they will have enough witnesses. If Jesus says something that's against the Roman government, then they'll say, oh, we have all these people here who will testify on our behalf that Jesus has spoken against Rome, and we can produce these witnesses. And therefore, they will arrest Jesus and maybe they'll execute him, but we'll be done with him. So they kind of concoct this plan. And then they roll it out in verse 21, like this. So they asked him, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach rightly and show no partiality, but truly teach the way of God." So they come out the gate trying to flatter Jesus, you know, trying to say these things to him. Trying to conceal their true intentions, their true motives. And they kind of come at him with these three statements. You speak and teach rightly. This is kind of refers to his accurate presentation of God's kingdom and what he's been saying thus far. They say, you show no partiality. As we've spoken of many times in the past, and as we've studied various passages, you see that this is the idea of not showing favoritism to people on the basis of their ethnic background or their financial background or their social background or whatever it is. There's no favoritism that's being shown by Jesus. And they tell Jesus, basically, Jesus, we know that you're someone who's not afraid to challenge the Roman government. We know that you're a straight shooter. You're not worried about even speaking against the Jewish leadership. You're your own man. Nobody owns you. You got it. You can do whatever you want. Nobody is shaping how you think about things. You're just it by yourself. And so they kind of say, like, you show no partiality, right? This thing. And then they say, finally, you truly teach the way of God, right? So this is the idea of, as you break down the kind of those Greek phrases there, it basically means like you teach the way of righteousness. The things that you say and you do, they are righteous. They lead you into right living before God. And so what you say, it goes. This is how it ought to be, because you're the one who is speaking and teaching rightly. You don't show favoritism. Nobody owns you, and you're leading us into this right living before God. And so they kind of come with this real big butter up for Jesus. Like, we got to like really kind of get you ready, Jesus, to hear this. So that way he's going to lower his guard and he's going to start to say the things that you know, they really want to hear. And they will get to that. They will get to that. They praise him, you know, kind of with these opening lines. You're going to be faithful at any cost. It doesn't really matter. Hoping, you know, that he's going to speak against the Roman government, speak against Caesar. And, you know, I think This is kind of like watching a situation when you're watching like a TV show or a sitcom where you just, you're kind of in the audience and you're looking at it and you're just like a little bit cringing. Like, this is a terrible setup. Like, you guys are about to really, get it, because he sees straight through this. But the reality is like, most of the time, this is kind of how we try to manipulate Jesus in our lives. This is most of the time we're just kind of like, you're kind of like trying to like sort of be like, God, I really want to like honor you. And like, you're just all the things that you lead us into are just, they're exactly the right way. And so like, I'm just really want to go wherever, but really you're just kind of saying that because you want them to go your way. You're kind of really trying to present the things that, that you're really willing. You're not remotely interested in anyways, right? You kind of ever, be in that situation with God where you're like, Lord, if you give me this, then like I'll like live this way or get rid of this. And like the thing you're like offering up as like this sacrifice to get rid of, like you're not remotely interested in that anyways. You're just like, you're just putting something out there to, but he knows, he sees. A lot of times we will come to him and be like, God, I know that you don't show favoritism, but you're really hoping he's going to show you favoritism and be like, but just give me like my thing, like my one thing that I want. I'm looking for this. And so we, as much as we can sit at a distance and look at this perspective, a lot of times this is us. A lot of times this is how we approach God, how we want to bargain with him and use him to get what we want. But as you'll see here with these men, he doesn't take the bait. He's not interested in producing something that is going to give them what they're looking for. The irony of this whole thing is that they say these things to him with poor motives, with bad motives, with evil motives. But the things that they say to him could not be more true. Because in fact, he is one who would speak and teach rightly. He is one who shows no partiality. He is one who truly teaches the way of God. And so even in this evil motive, even in this hidden motive, they are still speaking true words. It's their own words are testifying against them. They are putting themselves in a position of false humility, but it's really those declarations that convict them. And so as they speak this, they don't mean it, but it's more true than they know. And so they roll out their trick question after buttering Jesus up and being like, oh, I know that whatever you say goes, the way that you lead us, it's 100% correct. You don't show favoritism. You're not afraid to speak against Rome. You're not afraid to speak against the religious leaders. And so we have this really, this hot question for you that, we're really looking for your feedback on. Here's the question. Verse 22. Is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not? Right? So basically the goal, the idea is this. Jesus, what do you think about paying taxes to the Roman government? So the people of Judah began paying taxes to Rome around 6 AD when Caesar Augustus terminated the rule of this other guy called Archelaus. He's the son of Herod the Great, if you're into history. But he kind of made this region a Roman province, and he brought this to them, and obviously it was a wildly unpopular rule that was established here, a wildly unpopular law. Because as Rome demanded these taxes, as they demanded this tribute, it wasn't just the financial impact that they opposed. Yes, there it stinks like to not have to not have like this money that you were thinking you had and having to pay it out. Yes, that's a bummer. But for them, this was an emotional issue. Because this pictures for them, in complete economic terms, their absolute subjection to Rome. It's a symbol of like, we are not in charge and we are under the rule of another. That we have to deliver up this tax. We have to pay this tax to an oppressing empire. So there's someone who is over us, and now they're demanding this particular financial contribution on a regular basis. So it was a reminder all the time that they weren't free to do whatever they wanted, to go wherever they wanted, to live however they wanted. It was a reminder of this in their lives. And so, of course, this was a wildly unpopular law. According to first century historian Josephus, who we've mentioned many times, in the institution of this rule, there was a Galilean named Judas who started this kind of like widespread opposition, and it was like this, you know, basically turned into kind of this riot situation. And his idea was maintaining that that God was sovereign over Israel, and that Rome shouldn't have this sovereignty. And so they were like, "We're not. This guy was leading this charge. We're not paying this. This is you know, we're against it." As you fast forward to AD 66, this taxation was a clear part of the Jewish revolt there, which led to the ultimate destruction of Jerusalem in 70. And so there's a massive issue that's been going on for like decades, and nobody's happy about this. And so these people who are these spies who are sent from the Jewish leaders, who are they come to Jesus and they ask him this question about these taxes, this tribute. The idea here is we are going to discredit Jesus either in the eyes of Rome, and they're going to say, well, Jesus is a rebel and he doesn't want to pay taxes, and so Rome will deal with him. Or Jesus is going to say, no, you should pay your taxes, and then the Jewish people will be like, well, you're for Rome, and then they will be happy about getting rid of him, and then he will diminish in popularity. And so that's what's going on here when they ask, is it lawful to pay this tax? And in effect, they're asking, are God's people exempt from paying taxes to this foreign occupier? Are you loyal to Israel, Jesus? Or are you looking for its independence? Or should we submit to Rome? So we kind of just put on the spot here. Are you going to oppose this? Are you going to be a rebel? You're supposed to be this promised Messiah who we think is going to come in and overthrow Rome. What's going to happen here? So this is kind of the quandary that they pose to Jesus. Either way, they're thinking, okay, well, we are going to have victory here because someone is going to just discredit Jesus in this situation, one of these groups, and they'll deal with him. So here's what happens in verse 23. But he perceived their craftiness and said to them, show me a denarius. Whose likeness and inscription does it have? And they said, Caesar's. So Jesus responds by calling for the denarius, which is the basic monetary unit of this time. It represented an average day's wage. We've talked about this before. And on this silver denarius, it was an image on one side that bore Caesar's head, an inscription there, or it had an imprint of him. And then there was an inscription that said, Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus, right? So it's basically calling him kind of like this god. And then on the reverse side of the coin, there was the portrayal of his mother, Livia, and she was represented as the incarnation of the goddess of peace, along with the inscription below, high priest or chief priest. So you got like this coin with a flip side that had kind of a god and goddesses on it as it was being said there. And so Jesus, he says, does anybody have a coin? Right? Which is kind of a funny thing if you think about it, because like they all know what it is. And he asked them for it. And sometimes people, you know, some scholars are kind of be like, well, like, we don't know if Jesus ever carried money. And clearly he didn't because, you know, he the couple times that he did, he had to ask like the disciples to go find money to pay like taxes. And then this other time, like he didn't have one in the crowd. But I don't think that's what's happening here. It's not that Jesus didn't have this on him necessarily. As you look at this, I think what you're seeing here, as he asks the crowd for a coin, right? How many people were like, oh, like, I want to participate in this. They're looking for the coin. Like, this is going to be great, right? Or all of these spies are like pulling them out. Like, oh, I've got a coin. I've got a coin. They all have it. And what Jesus is doing there is saying, you guys, you all use the money. You all use it. So as much as you think, like, should we pay taxes to Caesar? You all have it in your pockets. You guys all have this. You all get paid in it. Everyone has it. So it's not like, oh, should we give the taxes to Caesar? You're already carrying it around with you all the time. So clearly you're willing to operate in the boundaries of this empire. Clearly you've already made a decision here about what you think. They indicate that, oh yeah, we trade with this. We participate in this government. In fact, if you look back into chapter 16 of Luke, remember Jesus says that the Pharisees are lovers of silver. Right? They are all about it. They can't get enough. And so Jesus asks them, who has this? Who's got the coin? So they produce the coin. And then he says, whose inscription, whose likeness does it have? They say Caesar's. Now, when Jesus does this, stroke of genius, because what is he doing there? He's framing it out into who owns this coin. It's the image bearer, the way that coins were minted in this time. It's whoever's image is on it, right? You're operating in Caesar's empire. It was his money that was being loaned to you in exchange for goods and services that was representative, but it belonged ultimately to him. It belonged ultimately to him. So it was a reminder that this, he owns it. So he could recall it on demand. It could be used in trade and practice there. But when Jesus does this, and he says, whose likeness and inscription does it have? That word likeness there, it's also the same word that is used in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, for image. Image. To describe something being made and representative of something. The likeness on the coin is Caesar's image. It belongs to him. It's made in his image. And Jesus frames it up in this way so as to draw his hearers into a reference. Into the opening words, right? Remember, these are master scholars of the Old Testament. They know exactly what's happening here. So, they would be familiar with Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. There's some sections before it, but that also reference similarly, but I'm just going to give you this one, where we read this. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So God is made, man is made in the image of God. This coin is made in the image of Caesar. So Jesus pulls these together. He uses this reference here with them. And then what does he say in verse 25? He said to them, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. So the coin belongs to, it bears Caesar's image. And so thus belongs to Caesar. If the people used Caesar's currency, they were under obligation to pay back what they owed him. But then Jesus goes beyond that original question. He always takes it to the next level. And he says, people have a parallel debt to God. By the same logic, in the same way, that which bears the image of God, all of humanity, then belongs to God. So you give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, but give to God what belongs to God. And so the question then comes about, not about money, but again about authority. Whose authority are you under? Are you operating under your own authority? Are you operating under the authority of Rome? Or do you recognize that you are made in the image and likeness of God? And in doing so, in recognizing this, this means the implications of it are that you then belong to him and you've got to operate with his direction, his nature, his character. You've got to follow him wherever he leads you because he is the one that's made you. This comes back to origins and authority. And so Jesus' response, it challenges those spies, it challenges the religious leaders, it challenges the whole crowd and anyone who is listening to show proper allegiance to God, to devote your lives to him. Now, in doing so, he frames up several passages. We'll look at one from Luke that speak to how those who are seeking to operate as followers of God should live in accordance with money. So there is some financial component to it. But mainly, this is about authority. And that authority of recognizing that you bear the image of God, and if that has implications for your life, it then says that you need to reorient the way that you live, the way that you think, the way that you make decisions, the way that you spend your time, your money, your resources, the way that you relax and rest. All of these things are reshaped by this understanding of who you belong to. You don't belong to yourself, you belong to God. And so there are several passages. We will just look at one here first from the early chapters of Luke where John the Baptist, remember, he was the one who came before Jesus and Jesus referenced in the previous passage about authority there. And he said, you know, Jesus is coming after me and he's got greater authority and he's going to baptize you with the Spirit and with fire. But when he was out there baptizing people in John chapter 3, John the Baptist was dealing with these guys who were tax collectors, right? If you recall back in chapter 3, verse 12, we read this, tax collectors also came to be baptized and said to him, teacher, what shall we do? Now, why are they asking that question? Because tax collectors were prototypically people who took advantage. They made their living taking advantage of other people. They worked for Rome. They took the amount that Rome demanded. And then they just like, totally took as much as they wanted from the different people who they were taxing. And what does he say in 3:13? He said to them, collect no more than you are authorized to do. He basically just says there, follow the rules that are prescribed. Like, don't take advantage of people, just the basics. Just be faithful with the basics. So he doesn't make it more complicated than that. He just says to these guys, don't take advantage of people. Be just. Be fair. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. They operate in such a way where they are going to take the taxes that they're required to take to be faithful to serve Caesar, and then they are going to go down into the water and be baptized and give their lives to God. It's those two things that happen there in John chapter 3. We see, secondly, in the New Testament, in Paul's letters, these chapters back to back with this idea of rendering to God the things that are God's, and then in the following chapter, rendering to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. In Romans chapter 12, verse 1, Paul opens with these words, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. So here we find that he is calling for Christians to make a decision and live in such a way, therefore, that they are giving the totality of themselves, right? Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. You are offering up each day yourself to God to follow him, to walk with him, to obey him in body, soul, and spirit. And then what does he say here? This will transform your mind, right? And then when you have a transformed mind, then you make decisions out of that transformed mind. You walk out of that transformed mind that's renewed by God. And then what does he say? Three things that you discover in the process of that that are very similar to what these spies say about Jesus. What is in Romans chapter 12, 2, the last three descriptions there? That by testing, you may discern what the will of God is, what is good, acceptable, and perfect. Right? That is very similar in description to what the spies say about Jesus. We know that you walk the righteous path. We know that you show no partiality. We know that, you teach true and straight. They're very similar here. And so he says you're going to discern this by the renewal of your mind, by submitting yourself to the Lord. Okay? That's in Romans 12. Then you flip to Romans 13, and it says, now let's deal with Caesar's sphere. So here's the instructions for Christians in Romans 13, verse 1. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. So then he leads with that same thing, the authority. God has the authority. Rome doesn't have the authority. We don't have the authority. God has the authority. Then he says, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is a servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Okay, now we come to this. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For the authorities are ministers of God according to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. So there's the short list. He gives you the first section in chapter 12. You give your entirety of who you are to God, body, soul, spirit, present yourselves in spiritual worship. Then here's how to operate under in this Roman sphere, under God's authority, as God has put him in charge. So render to God the things that are God's, the Caesar the things that are Caesar's. So there's some basic instruction here. And then finally, in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13, we read this. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to the governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Okay, so he just said there, there's a government in place and you should live there as in structure, as citizens of it. But then what does he do there? As he, after he acknowledges that there's an authority structure put in place, he says in verse 16, live as people who are free. So again, there's the tension of like, you are a free people living in a constrained space. There's always this tension that's at play. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. So he's laying this out. Again, this is about authority. Now, the goal here is not to figure out how to operate in the sphere of Rome to the best of your ability. The goal here is to work on the first section, the first goal in Romans chapter 12 that we read there, to renew your mind, to offer your body up as spiritual worship every day. Because without the renewed and transformed mind, you have no business operating in the sphere of Caesar. You won't know what to do. You will just act like everybody else. The goal is not for you to act like everybody else. The goal is for you to be a spirit-filled Christ follower operating in a foreign environment that you don't natively belong in. So you've got to have the renewed mind, the transformed mind, and then you've got to go out into this other sphere and to live as God's people there. And so this is what's happening as he's having this argument with the Pharisees and the people. He's telling them, the problem with you guys is that you're too eager to operate in the environment of Rome. You've got your pockets full of their money. You're trying to navigate the politics so that way you can stay in power. Your focus, your emphasis is on how can we be established here? How can we get what we want here? But the emphasis that Jesus is coming in with is You've got to give your life to God. You've got to follow Him. You've got to make decisions in such a way that you are willing to walk with Him, that you are willing to renew your mind day by day as you seek Him out. He's reminding them of His authority, of His power. Verse 26 tells us, as He speaks this, they were not able in the presence of the people to catch Him in what He said. They were entirely unsuccessful in their trap. He says nothing that they can use, because His answer is correct. He is, in fact, someone who is faithful to communicate on God's behalf, to speak and teach rightly, as verse 21 tells us, to show no partiality, to truly teach the way of God. They can't catch Him in anything because He is faithful to do all those things that they accused Him of. How do you catch someone who teaches rightly, who truly teaches the way of God? Marveling at His answer, they became silent. They had nothing to say. Now you'll find, I'm going to give you a little spoiler. By the time we get to chapter 23 and the religious leaders are standing before like the Roman authorities, they're going to tell them like, oh, Jesus prevented us from paying taxes to Caesar. It's like, really? Like we have a whole thing where he just said He didn't prevent you from doing that. They're going to fully make this whole thing up. They're going to lie. They're going to do the opposite of what He says here. He is someone who is teaching rightly. He is shooting straight with them. He's truly teaching the way of God. And they're going to leverage that and say, oh, no, he lies. And in doing that, they lie. And they're the opposite of what He has been laying out thus far. Marveling at His answer, they became silent. They had no response. They had nothing to say. The idea here is that they weren't marveling because they were impressed. It's because they had no comeback. They wanted to remain firm in their pursuit of trapping Jesus, and they were unable to do so. And I think like this is where we kind of tend to get into the argument with God ourselves, right? Kind of like we talked about before, where we're trying to butter God up sometimes when we're talking to Him about what we want. Sometimes He comes back with us and says like, oh, like here's what I'm trying to do. And then you're just kind of like, oh, that's not what I wanted. And you don't have a comeback because you don't really want what He wants to give you. You're looking to manipulate. You're looking to find an answer that you want, that you agree with, an outcome that you are looking for. But that's not how Romans 12 works. You offer yourself up as a living sacrifice. You offer yourself up as spiritual worship. What that is the idea of like you're putting yourself aside and saying, here I am. Like a sacrifice is something that's presented with no will. It's the end of the road. It's dead. That you come and you say, okay, I've got no more escape, no more decisions. I'm not trying to go my own way anymore. So you just throw yourself as an offering unto the Lord and say, whatever you want to do, like, let's go. I'm done trying to get my own way. This is where Jesus wants us to be. He wants to lead us here because in this process, He has our best interests in mind. That's been the story thus far. That's what we've been studying all throughout the Gospel of Luke, that when all these people are still hating them, He's still going to the cross on their behalf. He's going to pay for their sin in the midst of all of this animosity and anger and frustration and hatred and bad motives. He fully knows, just like He fully knew that they were presenting these things as a trap. He fully knows that this is the situation as he still goes to the cross on their behalf and on our behalf. Christ died to save sinners. He came to seek and save the lost. It's our turn to respond and to say, we see that faithfulness, we see that sacrifice, and we want to respond in kind. We want to say thank you, we want to follow you, and we want to offer ourselves up to you as a living sacrifice. It's like that simple. It's just that decision. Like today is the day where I'm going to offer that up. I'm going to decide I want to be someone who is following Jesus. I'm going to pivot from someone who's being a spy in the trenches to someone saying, all right, Jesus, you got me. That makes sense. I'm going to present myself to you now as an act of worship. To say, I'm done, I'm surrendering, I'm going to be that living sacrifice. We're going to respond now. We're going to pray, we're going to respond now. And as we jump into, this song, it's a time for us to kind of think about that, to respond as to what he has done, what he has accomplished. And we can respond in thanksgiving and gratitude, or we can become more firm in our opposition. But one thing you can't do is pretend like nothing happened. It doesn't work. You might be tricking yourself, but he knows. You have to respond. There's no choice. You either open yourself up and say, I want to move in the direction of you, Jesus, or you become more firm and I'm more solidly opposed than against you. Those are the only two ways. And so when you consider what he has done, what he has accomplished, let the Spirit move you as we respond with this song and as we receive communion together. If you are a Christian and you want to receive communion with us together this morning, we welcome you to do that to your upper the upper left here towards the piano. There's the bread and the cup there and the little capsules. So please come during the song and hold on to it. Grab one and hold on to it, and then we'll receive together after.